Artists Mean Business, interviews with Chicago's innovators. I'm Jess Kazweiner, and today I'm here with Don Hall, director of live events at WBEZ and host of The Moth. So first, thank you so much for being with me today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So, you know, I always like to kick it off and take a look back and think back on when you first started out as a young budding artist. Was there a moment when you said, I am an artist, or that you really, like, you came out?
I would say probably the earliest memory I have of saying, oh, this is what I'm going to do, is my grandfather was a very big influence on my life. He was an old Southern gentleman, not really so much a gentleman. He was an oil rigger. He was in Patton's 1st Division Army. Any picture you see of George S. Patton in World War II with an entourage, and there's a very good chance that my grandfather's in that picture. He was a machine gunnery sergeant, and he was a joker. And he had a really mean sense of humor and fun. And when I was six, I vaguely remember this, but it's a story that my mom tells a million times, is one day my grandpa told everybody in the room that when I walked in from school, so it must have been seven, eight years old maybe, when I walked in from school, when I walked in the door, everybody was to laugh like I had done something hysterically funny. And then so I walked in, because he just wanted to see what I do. So I walked in the door, and everybody screams of laughter. And I don't know what I did. So instead of asking them what I did, I left and came back in the same way to try to figure out why they're, and they laughed again. I did this 20 times. And by the time they were screaming with laughter, not anymore to trick me, just because I was such an idiot trying so hard to figure out what I was doing that was making them laugh. And I guarantee you, at that moment was the moment where I went, this somehow cosmically, I'm going to do this, whatever this is, this thing. I want to figure this out, and I want to do this forever. I've played trumpet since I was six. My uncle was a trumpet player in the Marine Corps band, and bought me a pocket trumpet, which is a full trumpet but mashed down so that small hands can hold it. And so he taught me how to play trumpet. That I actually did that in college, as well as being as an equity musical theater person. I did that. I played with Harry Connick Jr. before anybody knew who he was. And then when I came to Chicago, I decided to start a theater company after doing Second City, because it was exactly what I wanted to do.
It sounds like your family was a big impact and, you know, gave you a lot of support.
Oh, yeah. My mom's been married a number of times. So I kind of feel a little bit like it was a single parent thing. Because most of my stepdads really didn't care to have children. We just happened to, my mom was hot, super hot. And so that's kind of how it worked out. But my mom supported, it was the mistake that she made, but it was the greatest mistake you can make as a parent, is to convince your child that they are special. One of the things that kind of goes back is when I was 5 years old, I had meningitis, spinal meningitis. And my mother was told straight up that I was going to die. I mean, the doctor said, he's going to die. There's no way he's going to survive.
At 5.
And yeah, 5 years old. And if he does survive, it's about a 98% chance he's going to be severely brain damaged, or he'll be blind, or never walk again kind of thing. And I pulled out of it. Well, my mom's Irish, which meant I was saved by God for something special, right? So I grew up with that specter that everything I did was something amazing because God saved me from, you know, and actually before mom became very religious, which was not until I was like in high school, it was that I was saved by the universe, and then it became saved by Jesus, and okay, same diff, you know, but it was that I was special, that whatever I was going to do, it was going to be amazing. I was the one. I was Keanu Reeves in The Matrix. That's what I was, and I grew up with that mentality, and it took me almost 50 years to figure out that I'm really not the one, and I'm really not that special, but I appreciate that my mom did that for me.
Well, you know, I always say to people, what do you think the tools in your toolbox are that enabled you to be successful? So, you know, I'm going to infer that one of those things was the support of your family, but if you were to say something that you personally put in your toolbox, maybe, or even something that you found on your way, that enabled you to be successful outside of just the innate ability to entertain?
Ooh, I would say that the things that came naturally are that I can talk more than any human being I know. I mean, that if I were a superhero, my superpower would be a nonstop verbiage that I can talk relatively intelligently about any topic, whether I know anything about it or not. I'm a great bullshitter. I'm Irish. I would also say that I have sort of the blind confidence that only comes when you are white and male in this society. And somewhere along the line, if there's a thing that I would say is my greatest toolbox tool, is it's the ability to embrace failure in a big way. And I don't believe in making small mistakes. I believe in making the biggest fucking mistakes you can make, and then learning from it, and trying to make that work. And so I'm a fan of just going out there and trying the most ridiculous thing. I believe that. You know, I mean, I know there's a school of thought that says tried and true is the way to go. I believe that sometimes it's the best thing to do just because it's not like anything else. Sometimes it's just better to do something completely outside the box just because it's different, for crying out loud, because we live in such an entire society of mediocrity, of doing things the same way. You never learn anything but how to do it the same way from being successful over and over doing the same thing. You have to try things different, and it's ultimately why I'll never be famous or rich for creating anything, but I'm okay with that.
I disagree, though. I think that the people who are innovating in the technology sphere are doing things differently and are becoming very successful and financially so.
Oh, I think it... No, I'm not saying it can't happen. I'm saying it mostly doesn't, and sure. Especially in the arts.
It's a little bit of a needle in the haystack.
Yeah, especially in the arts, is those who are the most innovative in the arts, you get a flash, you get a Blue Man Group. Once in a while, you get a Blue Man Group, which, can you imagine the pitch session of the Blue Man Group? We're going to do a show, and it's going to be blue guys, and they're all going to be bald, and they don't speak, and they drum with paint. Nobody's going to finance that. Well, that's why they started in Central Park, just doing it for fun, doing a thing called the Death of the 80s. And then they were seen by Johnny Carson, and Johnny Carson pulled them on because they were so freaking weird, but seriously talented.
They started that long ago?
That's exactly how they started, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then Leno had them on, and then they started their thing, and now it's a global enterprise, mm-hmm. and there are blue men all over the place, and they barely changed their show since then. But the reality is, that's something that's bizarrely unique, completely outside of the box, and still worked. Most people that are doing things outside of the box, most people that are really doing some experiments in art, are not wildly successful, and that's okay. Again, it depends on what your definition of successful is. If successful is money, not that many that are successful with money. If successful is successful in the creation, they're all successful. They're creating, you know? And that really is more my rubric for success anyway. Money's never been one of those things that matters to me that much.
Well, you said something about, you know, making a lot of mistakes, which is this sort of beautiful and organic thing that happens. And I want to ask you, if you had to pick one that was maybe, you know, your sweetest mistake, what would that be, and maybe also what was the lesson that you learned from it that you can share with our listeners?
I would say the sweetest mistake, it was just complete, I don't know if it was hubris or just stupidity, but in 2000 we had, I ran a theater called WNEP Theater for about 20 years, and we started right out of Second City. Joe James and Jeff Hoover and I started the company, and it stands for What No One Else Produces. And in 2000, we decided the Turnaround Theater over on the corner of Halsted and Belmont opened up. It's now the Playground. It opened up, and I wanted that theater. We wanted to. We'd hit a point where we'd done enough shows, rented out of other people's spaces, figured out how to make other people's sets feel like we created them for our show, kind of thing. And it was time for us to have our own clubhouse. And so I signed a lease for $3,000 a month plus the utilities when the company had $18 in the bank and no way of making more than that. We didn't have any money at all. And that was just such a huge... And nobody knew. I didn't tell anybody in the company that I'd signed a lease with no money. I just decided we had to have it and we'd figure it out. And sure enough, We did. We figured it out. We just...
It's that white male hubris.
Yeah, yeah. It was like, I can't be stopped because I want this to happen, and we're going to do the best we can. And we managed, and we had that space for 3 years. And, you know, and it was... And we produced tons of material. And in that time, because we had the freedom, that space allowed us... I mean, granted, at one point I had to cash in. I was a Chicago public school teacher for about 8 years. And so I cashed in my pension, which you're not supposed to do when you're not retiring, but I cashed in my pension so that I could pay rent on the space. At the end of the day, and that's ultimately why I stopped producing that theater, was that I found that over the course of like a 5-year span that I dropped about $150,000 of my own money. You know,
this was pre-Kickstarter.
Yeah, this is way pre-Kickstarter. I wouldn't do that anyway. I just have a personal... I'm not a big crowdsource fan when it comes to money. But that's... I get it. I understand it. If it's successful, far out. You got to do what you got to do. But yeah, I said, you know, so we did it. And we went to New York a couple of times. We went to the Edinburgh Festival Fringe and were highly successful. We got on the cover of the art section of the New York Times when we did a show there. We got to perform a Dada show that I directed at PS122. I mean, it ended up being that one, oh shit, I've got $18 in the bank, but I'm going to sign my name to this lease. And God, I hope we can figure out how to pay the rent before they figure out we don't have any money. Was a huge, stupid thing to do, but my God, it paid off in spades. It paid off for 3 years of just show after show after show, and just great experiences.
So at that time, what would you say to your younger self, or even, you know, before then? Like, what advice, if you could talk to your younger self, your 22-year-old self?
Oh, at that moment when I signed the lease?
Well, whatever.
The only thing I would tell my 22-year-old self, holy crap, the only thing I would tell my 22-year-old self is don't worry about fame and money. Don't worry about it. Because when I was 22, I wanted to be famous, and I wanted to make a lot of money creating art, and I wanted our theater company that was more like 25, but I wanted our theater company to be the next Steppenwolf, like everybody that starts a theater company. I want to be the next big thing. And what I realized along the way was the pursuit of being the next best thing is its own Ouroboros. You're eating your own tail all the time, trying to please people you can't predict. You're trying to, you know, because to be very successful in the arts is that you really have to find a common denominator of the most people that will like you. You know, the largest percentage of the population that thinks you're cool. And the more of those people you do, the more watered down it becomes. The more sort of basic it has to be. You know, it's, look at Michael Bay movies. They're super popular, but really, come on. They're written like an eighth grader wrote them. Okay. Titanic's one of the most popular movies in history. And it is. It reads like an eighth grader wrote the damn thing. It's super simple. And it has to be so that lots of people will flock to see it. The stuff that's more specific, the more... You know, and I'm not even saying that it's more intelligent. It's just more specific. Is not going to appeal to a large base of people. But it will really appeal to a very niche audience. And so my perspective was... What I would tell my 22-year-old self is, don't worry about that shit. I believe there are two kinds of people in the world. There are two kinds of people. Everybody bakes a cake. And one kind of person bakes a cake and they eat the cake and they like the cake, but it's not a good cake until 7 other people like the cake. And then it's a good cake. And then there's other people that bake the cake and they eat the cake. And if they like the cake, they don't give a flat fuck if anybody else likes the cake. They like the cake. It's a good cake. If they are a good baker on some level, there's going to be a couple people that like that cake as well, because they're not that far outside the, you know, the norm. I believe when I was 22, I was the first kind. I wanted everybody to like my cake. And it wasn't a good cake unless everybody liked my cake. And now I don't care if people like my cake. I do what I do. I enjoy, you know, I enjoy doing it. It's sort of like, you know, I don't know, being a runner. You know, if you're worried about what people think you look like, you're not really doing a great job of running. If you don't care what you look like and you just run, then you're doing the thing, and that's good. And so that's the advice I give myself, is don't worry about all that shit, because it does. It, in the end of the day, none of it's going to matter. It's fascinating to me that we live in this age where the internet is very readily accessible, and articles that were written decades ago, you just pull them up, and so many of them that you read on Facebook are, here's what seven people that were dying for the last year of their life, these are the things that they regretted. Or here's somebody that died of cancer, and right before he died of cancer, he said that this is the meaning of life. And we hear it, and we all go, yeah, it's not about the money, and it's not about the job, and it's not about all this stuff. And yet, we hear it, we agree it, we go to bars, we talk about it ad nauseum, and then we fucking go back and spend all of our energy on the job and the bills. And so that at the end of the day, what are you going to look at when you're looking at your, gosh, look at how much money I paid to ComEd. I'm so proud of my life. What a load of shit. And so... I just, that's the advice I give myself.
So defer your student loans as long as you can.
Yeah, who gives a shit?
That's my life.
I mean, who cares? I mean, it's like, it's just money. It's just numbers on a page. You will survive without all that crap.
And, you know, I work in arts marketing a lot, and I help artists, and a lot of times they want the butts in seats, right? They want to fill the room. Yep. And what I try to get across is you don't want to fill the room. You want the right people in the room. And it's really important to know who your audience is so that you're targeting them in your messaging. And you have your audiences, but it's not for everyone.
Yeah.
So don't try to be for everyone. And I feel like that's something that we in our artist selves should take note of. But, you know, it's also in our workplaces, yeah, wherever we may be. You're not for everyone.
Yeah, write the book that you want to read, not the book you want everybody else to read.
So, you know, I mentioned before the podcast recording started that this is a sort of homage to young people who are on the come up. Do you have advice for folks as an educator or at WBEC for young people looking to make it in the creative sector, whether that's here in Chicago or in other urban cities?
Yeah, don't listen to people like me. Because the thing about it is, when you're 20, when you're 23, you're supposed to think you know everything. You're supposed to have the arrogance of youth. You're supposed to go out there and say, fuck all this advice. I'm doing my own thing. The beauty of that is, you don't know what you're doing. You don't have a clue, and it's okay. Because that's how you make those big mistakes. That's how you create those experiences that make you a better artist down the line. Is, you know, is go out there and absolutely believe that what you're doing is the next Steppenwolf or the next Monet, or that you are the fucking badass of the world, and do it. Because life, trust me, life will kick you in the ass over and over. And the only thing, and here's one of those phrases, cliches, but I love these cliches, a kick in the ass is a step forward. Every time you screw up, you're going to get pushed in a direction. And if you're open to it and you're listening, then you can say, okay, what can I do better next time so that I don't get kicked in the ass next time? But ultimately, don't listen to anything I say. Go and do your thing and be brilliant, because, and be fearless. I guess it's an interesting thing. And this is another thing about my age, is I notice a lot of younger people that I work with are very career-minded, and they're very focused on having that career and being, you know, like sort of saying, I'm going to do this thing for the rest of my life until I'm rich or whatever it happens to be, you know? And the reality is, no one I know my age that is actually doing anything really successful and is really known for what they do ever knew they were going to be doing that when they started out. You know, I mean, I work with Peter Sagal. Peter Sagal did not start off as an NPR host. Peter Sagal wasn't even the original host for the show. Peter Sagal was a comedy writer. He wrote plays. He wrote a screenplay for Dirty Dancing Havana Nights, or Dirty Dancing 2 Havana Nights. He wrote that screenplay. It's one of the worst movies ever written. He's written plays. This was not what he was doing, and now he's doing this.
How was he discovered then?
He was hired to be a panelist because he was a funny guy for the very earliest shows of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. The original host did not work out. He was not funny. And Carl Castle was there and said, why don't you have Peter try it? And Peter tried it, and it just fit, mm-hmm. You know? And so, you know, it's one of those things, and I guess the advice I'd give my 22-year-old self and the advice I'd give to anybody that's a millennial right now that's trying to figure out what the fuck they're doing is, what you think you're going to be doing in 5 years, who you think you're going to be in 5 years, it doesn't matter how much you plan, you have no idea who you're going to be. You don't know who you're going to be, so be who you are now and know that in 5 years, something else, you'll be somebody completely different.
That's beautiful, you know, and I will add to that, and you saying, like, do your own thing, but I'll add to that, do something.
Always do something. The worst choice is to choose nothing.
Yeah. Right now, yeah. I see a generation that has a lot of apathy compared to a lot of young people who are doing the thing, right? Yeah. And so a lot of, I think, people maybe who are upwards of 45, 50, 60, they look at the millennial generation and they say, oh, you know, they're so apathetic. Oh, they're not doing anything. And so I feel like, for my own piece of advice to just tack on to mm-hmm. yours, yes, do your own thing, but for the love of God, do something.
Yeah, and when, you know, the only thing I would counter is I actually don't see apathy. What I see is fear. And I don't even see mm-hmm. fear of doing things. I see just an almost systemic fear of being wrong. The idea that if I try it and I'm wrong, that's the worst thing that can happen is that you can screw something up, that you can fail. There's this, and I don't know where it comes from, but there's a lot of anxiety in this particular generation, at least the people I work with. I don't want to generalize too much, but a lot of the artists that I work with that are you know, 18 to 26, I guess, mm-hmm. It's not that they're apathetic. They deeply care about what they do. They're just so terrified of fucking it up. And like, the idea is if you fuck it up once, you're done forever. And we've created this culture where you can go online and tweet a bad joke and have your life ruined, just destroyed by the Twitter shaming. You know, this mob mentality of let's just gang up. You know, the girl that she and her friend would go around and make the crazy pictures, the irreverent pictures of things. You know, they would get in front of a don't smoke, and then they'd smoke in front of it. And she went in front of the Arlington Cemetery, and it said, be respectful and quiet. And so they took a picture of her sitting right next to that picture, flipping someone off and looking like she's screaming. And they put it on Facebook, and nobody thought twice about it. They thought it was funny. A couple of her friends said, that's kind of bad taste, whatever. But a couple of years later, it got picked up, and she had like a million five people just, you know, die, I hope you get raped. And it ruined her life. It destroyed her life. And so I think there's this something about the culture that says if you make a mistake in this culture, you're screwed forever. And I guess that's where one of the moments where you have to go and look at Trump and know that, you know what? He doesn't give a shit. Now, he's an idiot, and you know, but there is something to be admired on some level for somebody that just speaks what they want to speak, and you cannot shame them into shutting up. And I think most of the millennials, rather than apathy, are just, they just don't want to be wrong. They don't want to make a big mistake because they feel like it's going to be for life.
And that it paralyzed by that fear.
Yeah, yeah. So. I talked to Lauren Chulgen, who is a reporter at WBEZ. She's 25, and she told me a story about a friend of hers who was terrified to take a shower because she didn't know if it would be clean. She just would get paralyzed. She would get in the shower. She'd get to the bathroom, and she wouldn't take a shower until she finally had to push herself to do it. And then she'd cry, you know, because she had all this anxiety going on. I mean, we have an entire generation of people that are more antidepressants and more anti-anxiety medication than almost any generation previous. And there's got to be a reason for that, and it's not the water. You know, there's something that's happened to this generation where they have been consistently told that if they're wrong, they're bad. And man, being wrong is the greatest gift you can give yourself.
And, you know, I'll add to that piece. I was talking to a friend of mine, and he said also, because we're on social platforms so much, but we're not talking face to face with people, they're seeking therapy as well, and clinical therapy, because they don't have the simple therapeutic nature of human contact. Yeah. And so in addition to, you know, your advice, I'll also say make sure that you're not substituting the human interaction with the social media interaction.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you look at social media and everybody looks like they're amazing or they're miserable. Fact is, no one knows what's going on. None of us do. Everybody puts the brave face everywhere. It's on social media. It's everywhere that they know what the deal is. Nobody knows what the deal is. Everybody I've ever worked with in marketing are fucking guessing every time. And if they're good at it, they guess well. But nobody really knows what's going on, and nobody really knows how to do any of this stuff. And the those of us that look like we do, it's all bullshit. It's all fake it till you make it, man. And it's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But none of us really know, and it's okay to not know. And it's okay to get up off your ass, not know, and try anyway.
You know, I always like to ask about the money thing, too. Like, okay, all this is great, but I gotta pay my rent, right? Mm-hmm. And, when thinking about being an artist, how do you negotiate, your creative self versus gotta pay the bills self?
I'm a firm believer. I was an equity actor for a long time. I've done the starving artist thing for a while. And the conclusion that I've come is that art's not a job. And that every time I've made art and the creation of art my job, I've learned to resent the art that I'm creating. And that's not always the case, but that's been my experience. I don't believe that art should be a job. I think art is a way of life. So my strong belief is get skilled at something you enjoy. I mean, that's things. I create public events. And I love doing it. It's a blast. I get to have a sense of artistry with that. I get to manipulate what the audience gets to see. It's not just planning parties. It's public radio, so it's not just planning booze parties. There's going to be an element of intelligence to it. There's going to be something for the audience to participate in that is fun and interesting. And then I get to create my art outside of that, and I have a blast doing it because I never have to go. When I go tell a story, I don't have to charge money for it. And the reason I don't have to charge money for it is my rent's already paid. So none of the pressure of I have to get an audience to come see me, I have to charge this much money, none of that comes into play for the art that I create because I work a job that pays my money that I happen to love. And I'm absolutely convinced. I'm happier than I've ever, and than most of the people that I know that are artists that get paid a lot of money. Well, it's not that many artists that get paid a lot of money. But the ones that get paid a lot of money is they have the autonomy. And that's really what money gives you. I mean, I always ask, what's more important, recognition, compensation, or autonomy? And I'm always going to be autonomy. I don't really care so much about the recognition. It's nice. I like to walk into a room, have everybody laugh, and me figure out what it is. But the recognition of who gets the credit for the thing has not really ever been my thing. Compensation for the art's never been a big deal for me. I'd rather give it away and have more people see it than charge a lot of money and only have rich white people see it. And so
get an amen.
Yeah. And so autonomy, being able to do what I want to do, say what I want to say, do it the way I want to do it, work with the people I'm interested in working with, that is far more important to me than fame or money. Always. And in the last, I'm going to say probably the last 20 years of my life, that has been the case, is that I work a job that pays my bills, because ultimately, bills are mundane, jobs are mundane. Paycheck's kind of a mundane thing. Got to have it, but the paycheck's kind of mundane. Paying your electric bill is not an exciting thing. It's not a great accomplishment. You don't walk around with a t-shirt saying, look at the fucking bill I just paid. That stuff, you got to do the mundane just to survive. The rest of it's gravy. And if you can figure out a way to do the mundane without having to suck all your energy away and then go and do your thing, man, you'll be the happiest person in the living. Yeah, because I guess that's, I was talking to my wife about it. It's like, I think a lot of people are seeking happiness. They're looking for happiness. And it hit me not too long ago. I've never sought happiness because I don't think that's something you can find. I've always sought meaning. As Shannon Kaysen, who has a podcast called Homemade Stories out of Detroit, and he said this once, and I thought it was brilliant. He says, I've hit a point where I no longer want to be successful. I just want to be significant. I love that. What a great goal. A great goal. Not to worry about the trappings of what success is or isn't. Just wants to be significant. Wants to have a legacy. Wants to create something that people can look back on that will inspire people, whatever it happens to be. And I think that's vital, And so, to me... work a job. Jobs are easy. You know, I mean, one of my favorite jobs I ever had in my whole life was as a night janitor. And I worked from midnight to 9 in the morning cleaning stinky restaurants. But it was mindless. It was easy. I didn't have to think about it. I created more comedy bits while I was mopping toilets and paying my bills than any time when I was just working in the theater. So it's like, okay, yeah.
I can do this.
This can be done.
So I want to end with a question for you. For the listeners, how can they find out about you, your work, your podcast? Where can we find you? What are things that you want people to know about that is either upcoming or down the pike?
It's been an accusation I get from a lot of people. I'm not very good at self-promotion because I just figure if it's good, you'll come and see it because you heard about it. I think you come to the Moth. And you don't have to come to the Moth that I'm at. Go to any Moth. Tell a story. It's not about the host. It's tell a story. You know, take advantage of that opportunity. I had a friend of mine that got very upset because he could never win the Moth. And so he stopped doing it. I said, "When did you stop doing it?" He said, "Well, I almost win every time I never win." I said, "Then you're doing it for the wrong reasons." He said, "What's the right reason?" I said, "It's an entire audience. It's almost always a packed house of people you don't know that didn't come to see you that you get to perform for. What else are you doing this for? You want to go, you go to almost any improv theater. You know, it's chess for chess players. The audience is primarily a bunch of improvisers, you know? It's like, well, that's what I love about The Moth is that because it's got that cachet, because it's got the podcast, because it's got the national radio show, people come that have no interest in telling a story and just want to hear stories. What a great opportunity. Do The Moth.
Podcast.
Yeah, Tyler and I have a podcast called General Admission. It is an arts podcast. What we do is we interview artists. And I am convinced that the people you've never heard of, you should have. But really, it's more about listening to the artists that we highlight. If you really have any interest at all in what I'm saying, you can go to my website, which is donhallchicago.com. And I have a blog that I've been writing for over 10 years of just me spouting off about just whatever the hell is in my brain that day.
Well, believe it or not, the things that are in your head are worth listening to.
Well,
so,
thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me, and I'm excited to be able to share your advice and words of wisdom, and I'll also share a link to your website and to your podcast.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.